John Wedger is a police whistleblower. As a CID officer, he discovered back coverings on child sex trafficking networks, which led to an investigative inquiry by the Independent Police Complaints Commission, delving into the depth of police involvement. He is one of the bravest men in the country today, by many people's reckoning. John Wedger, thank you for joining us. Please speak freely to this commission.
I'm recently retired from the Metropolitan Police, where I served as a detective. I specialised in child abuse investigations, and what is relevant to me being here today was my service whilst on the specialist vice unit. I had been asked to look into an allegation made by a 14-year-old girl that she is being used as a prostitute. On looking into it, it appeared that this girl was one of many. She gave me another girl, who in turn gave me another, and it just spiralled. Very, very quickly, we had dozens of young kids aging from 9 to 14 years old. All of them were subject to care orders, either looked after or, you know, in placements, homes or whatever, but all known to the social services. A lot of them were known to the police for being missing persons and everything else. And all of them were addicted to crack cocaine and heroin and were all being pimped out, as the term goes, by one person, which was a female prostitute who was very well known to the Met Police. And this woman had connections with, alleged connections with high-ranked officers and also a local magistrate and someone that was high up here, executive status in the BBC. This woman seemed to work with impunity for many, many years, and when looking into it, this actual racket had been going on for a long, long time. What I did was I exposed my findings, I committed them to paper in what was just a basic intelligence report, and I took it to a senior officer. And what I must say, that this isn't the first time that I'd been shut down for exposing child abuse offences. A couple of years prior to that, if I may jump the timeline, I was on an inquiry looking into transient paedophiles that had failed to register, and I found out that they were residing on canal boats within the inland waterway network of the UK. They had information from within the prison service that there were two paedophiles that were living on boats. Now, boats had a lot of poignancy in as much as there was freedom to travel. The canal network was very, very old and therefore didn't get policed. And children like boats. And the BBC had a programme at the time, which sort of, it was to do with two little dolls that lived on a canal boat called Rosie and Jim. And it was tied in at the same time as I was looking into this. So kids were drawn to the waterways. I'll get back to the main story, but the reason for telling this bit was that I was told that there were two sex offenders. I was asked to look into it as a field intelligence officer, and if I found another two within a set period of time, they'd be happy. Within that period of time, I'd found 90. I came into work, and I was told by a high-ranked officer that the inquiry had been shut down, and the reason given was that they couldn't afford the funding for me. But I had been approached by a Scotland Yard detective who told me, he said, when you investigate any crime and you do well at it, you get praised. When you look into child abuse cases, the opposite happens. Be very careful. He then told me about a cabinet minister that they'd investigated on a few occasions, and on each occasion they'd been shut down. So I was aware that this had gone on. When I questioned the senior officer about, you know, the real reason, he told me, John, I'm so sorry it's come from high up. There's nothing I can do. And promised me any job I wanted. So I moved on to the vice unit. So I was expecting to be praised for what I found out. Each day a new child would be found, and it was just spiralling. I was brought before someone who is now a very, very high-ranked officer in the UK indeed, and he sat me down and he said, John, I've got to be very upfront with you. And I said, well, I'd like to be upfront with you, Governor, as well. And he said, you know, you're out of all the officers I've got here, there was about, I don't know, 40 officers, he said, you're the second best one I've got. which was a good accolade, he said, but unfortunately, you've dug too deep. What the hell have you done? Now, on a personal level, since the beginning of 2000, I'd brought up four children on my own, and this was common knowledge within my unit. And he said to me, if you ever disclose what you found out, you will lose your home, your children, and your job. You must shut the F up. And he said, you will be thrown to the wolves. You have no idea who and what you are dealing with. He said, I'm warning you now, you must back away. And then he said something quite strange. And he said that if you say a word of this, and even if you make a complaint, it will come back to me and it will go in the bin. I and no one else will ever betray fellow rank. Shut your mouth. So I walked away from that investigation, and I moved on. I was offered to stay, but I couldn't. What was very strange was that the main witness, the young girl that came forward, was found dead in the street very shortly afterwards on a suspicious drug overdose, which sort of compounded matters. I then moved on to work on child abuse investigations, which is slightly different to Vice, and I can, if I have the time, explain why there is this compartmentalisation within these institutions. And it's all down to remits and justifiable reasons for actually doing nothing as opposed to doing something. I went on to a child abuse unit in one of the poorer boroughs of London, and I was asked if I would like, as well as an investigator, to take on a second role dealing with various sort of issues they have. And I was told, you'll get a day here and there to go to a meeting. And I asked to look into if there anyone was dealing with children's homes. I was told, no, there was an officer that was dealing with children's homes, but she left 2 years ago, and she didn't do anything anyway because nothing happens. There's no problem. And I asked this sergeant, are there any problems with child prostitution within the kids' homes? He said, what are you on about? No, of course not. I got a list, and this is almost real time as I'm telling it now. I got a list faxed through to me from social services with all the children's homes. There was 26 kids' homes. I picked up the phone and I spoke to the fella and I asked him how many kids they have. And on an average, there's about five children reside in these children's homes. And I said, no, I'm not pointing the finger. No one's in any trouble. How many of these children do you lose at the weekend? Which is the usual pattern of missing, you know, when kids go missing. So out of the five, we lose three. And I said, no, honestly, what happens to them? They went, oh, they're being pimped out. So I'd found this officer that had dealt with it for years had found none within this. Honestly, this was the time as we're speaking now. Within this period of minutes, I'd found three. By the end of that day, I'd found six. By the end of 3 days to 5 days, I'd found 50. I held a meeting with all the concerned agencies, which involved charities, which involved NGOs, which involved social services, and I highlighted the problem. And I was then harangued, really. I was attacked verbally by head of children's services for this borough, saying to me, what the effing hell have you done? And I said, well, you knew about these kids. I said, yeah, but they hadn't come notice, so we're not worried. The children were making money, so therefore the children weren't worried. The children had a boyfriend, which was their pimp. Therefore, they thought this was love. And the children were also using drugs. So therefore, they want to continue to use drugs. So they weren't coming to notice. So therefore, social services had written them off, despite the fact that the children's homes would constantly be getting in the logs that they were being picked up and they were going missing. These were regular missing persons. The police have a missing persons unit. They say so many thousands of kids go missing every year. They do, but a lot of them do return. But what is never looked into is what happens when they're going missing. They are working as prostitutes. And again, the child abuse units won't look into them because they say it's not interfamilial, because it's someone else pimping them out. The bigger cities have vice units. Vice units will not deal with them because they say that these are kids subject to care orders. So no one looks into it, and it goes on and it festers. And it festers. And then, funny enough, after this meeting, I was shut down and moved again. I then came forward a couple of years later. I was actually genuinely concerned that I would lose my children. I know how powerful the police are, and I know what they're capable of, having worked with them. I blew the whistle a few years ago, and I was told that my allegations would be taken at the highest level. I asked to speak to a high-ranked female detective, and this was questioned. And then they did get me a high-ranked female detective, and she said to me, "Why are you talking to me and no one else?" I said, "Because you cannot roll up your trouser leg." And she said, "I understand exactly what you mean." They instigated allegations of corruption against high-ranked officers. When you investigate these crimes, as a witness and informant as I was, you're meant to get regular updates every 28 days. I never received one in 3 years. The matter was passed from one unit to another unit. It ended up with the IPTC, who again did nothing and failed to update me despite the fact that they had corroborating evidence. I met with other police whistleblowers via a few concerned MPs. One of them was a lady called Maggie Oliver, who had exposed the scandal in Rochdale. Another one was a man called Lenny Harper, who had exposed the horrendous goings on at a kid's home called Hope de la Garenne in Jersey. Each one of them echoed each other. They both said, "They're going to come for you, and they will come hard." And I said, "What do I expect?" They said, "Right, you will be served with gross misconduct papers. You will be interviewed, they will find against you, you will be sacked, and you will probably face a court case and may go to jail." Now, the threats that was echoed to me, "You'll lose your home, your job, your children." At the same time, the police stopped paying me. I went without wages for nearly 3 years. I had four children at home. Then what happened was that they served me gross misconduct papers. And I was told what it will be for data protection violations, which seems to be a common occurrence. I got served with numerous data protection violations. Each one could have given me a 2-year prison sentence. And this continued and continued. Now, what also happened during this period was that one of my children was involved in a life-changing and catastrophic accident in which he was initially declared dead. They revived him. He was on life support for many, many months. I got a call from the hospital to attend the hospital where they had actually lost him. He'd been dead for 10 minutes. So I was called down to the hospital to basically identify him. I turned up and they had actually revived him within this period, but they deemed him as brain dead, although he was on full 100% life support. A colleague of mine was so concerned, as I had no money, and for 3 days I slept in my car and stayed by my son's side. My son actually made signs of life, and I was able to return home. But my colleague had brought this to the attention of senior officers, just saying, "You know, you've got to help this man. He's actually done nothing wrong." The Met Police's response to this, when I got home, they'd sent two child protection officers round to interview my youngest boy on allegations that I'd left him home alone while I was with my dying son. So the threats of "you will lose your home, your job and your children" rang true. I persisted. I refused to give up. And I set up a forum, a working group with all the police whistleblowers. And it extended and it branched out. The IPCC stopped investigating the crime. I was meant to be given a full breakdown of what went on, and I was given a one paragraph letter and told not to contact them again. We're not investigating it. Their answer was that the three high ranked officers that I'd accused of corruption, they went and spoke to them and they denied it, and that was the extent of their investigation. And all them years as an investigator, I've been doing it wrong. You've just got to ask someone if they've done it, and if they say no, that's it. And that was what they expected me to swallow, and told me not to contact them again. I took the matter to the policing minister at the time, a member of the Privy Council and a member of the government's cabinet. He met with me, and he was actually, to my surprise, appalled. He arranged for a meeting with the Home Office. The Home Office then got their independent investigation team involved and stated that there will be an independent investigation into my claims. And they deemed that the Met Police and the IPCC had failed and they were looking into it. I was summoned to a meeting and it was a fully recorded meeting, and it was witnessed, and in which the cabinet minister handed my paperwork over to the Home Office officials, and that was an official handover of the paperwork, which I supplied to him. They then gave me their assurances that they will be in touch with me and give me a 24-hour contact number, and said they will investigate this independently. I never heard from them again. They have since denied receiving any paperwork. When pushed, they admitted they did receive it, but have now lost it. We are seeing police failings in respect to child prostitution hemorrhaging in this country, but we are seeing them on a provincial level. We're seeing them in Rochdale, Blackpool, Rotherham, we're seeing them in Oxford, Aylesbury, Swindon, all on a provincial level. London is one of the largest urban conurbations in the Western world. It has got one of the biggest police forces. We haven't heard one thing about organised child prostitution in London, and the reason being is that those high up have been covering it up, and this goes right to the heart. I was met with, as I said, Lenny Harper. Children were killed at Hôtel de la Garenne, in which Lenny Harper had forensic evidence, which was then went missing. And he said to me, be careful, what you're looking at will go right to the heart of the establishment. I sat down with the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Cressida Dick, and I explained to her what was going on. And I explained the dynamics of how you groom a child. I said, I can take a child out of a care system. I can groom that child. I can have sex with that child. I can get my friends to have sex with that child. I can pimp that child out. You have not appointed one officer to investigate that. Yet if I leant over my fence and called my neighbour a derogatory term, I'd lose my home, my job, I'd be signing on a register, and I'd never work for the Met Police again. How is that justifiable? How is it justifiable? I now work with victims and survivors of abuse. I help out with recovering alcoholics and drug addicts. I'm working in collusion now with one of the most notorious gangsters the UK had, and the convicted murderer, Chris Lambriano. And I've never had such support and compassion from these people, yet the police would have had me swinging from a rope if they've had their own way. When we look at our prison service, we look at our prison system, 75% of inmates are illiterate. This is in the UK, they're illiterate. 75% of our inmates have come from abused backgrounds. We have a recidivism rate of 75%. The system does not work. Child abuse is at the root of all of this. Child abuse units, when I was on them, I've worked on many specialist units in the police. I've worked on units that have been anti-government. I've worked on units that have been financial crime. You get given a car. You get given an expense account, you get given unlimited overtime. When I was on child abuse, we had a car between 10 of us. I worked with three alcoholics because the work was so horrendous and impactive. We had no respite. We were worked till we were dropping. And we would have appointments to see psychiatrists every 6 months, but they weren't to sign us off. They were to keep us going. Say, oh, you're all right, you're all right. Keep going, keep going. They deliberately underfund anything to do with child abuse, deliberately, and it's done for a reason. I had many informants that came from the street. They were beggars. They were drug addicts. They had all been sexually abused as children. One of them told me of a scenario when he was in a kid's home at the age of 4, was raped on his first night by a Catholic priest. He then went on to be raped daily and whipped and beaten. He became a drug addict and he ended up as a rent boy on the street at an area of the West End where I used to work as a vice copper. And that was what was classed as the meat rack in Piccadilly Circus, where young boys were openly picked up for the purpose of prostitution. It was known about. He went to get in a car and he was in trouble. He needed drugs, so he needed the money. And he had a pimp, and he said, a pimp wasn't a bad thing. A pimp actually looked after me. I was safer with a pimp on the street than I was in a kid's home. He went to get into a car, which was a white Rolls Royce with two men in it. And his pimp said, don't go in that car. The last two boys went in there. They killed them. We never saw them again. He gesticulated for the driver to drive around the block. And his pimp didn't see this. His pimp thought he'd walked away. But he didn't. He got in the car. He was then taken to a very affluent part of London called Hampstead. He was then subjected to 3 days of torture and sexual violence in which he said that they knew that they'd killed him. And he said they dumped his lifeless body on Hampstead Heath by the Royal Free Hospital, believing he was dead. And he said, what shocked me more, John, was the fact that these two men, they were well-dressed, they had a big house, and they were actually getting ready to go to their niece's wedding whilst they were dropping my lifeless body off, perceived lifeless body off, on a bit of heath ground. Yet it goes on consistently, consistently. Back in 2003, the justice system brought in what they called the Bad Character Act. Before, you could never bring in someone's previous convictions within a legal trial in the UK, unless it was a very, very serious one, and then it was very difficult. There were too many legal parameters. They brought this in, and everyone thought that it was a coup. It was a step forward in gaining justice. But when you commit minor acts of shoplifting, it's dishonest crime. You are then deemed a dishonest person. Every person I dealt with, every street person, every crack-taking prostitute had been abused as a child. They all committed dishonest crime to stay alive. Right? They shoplifted. They pimped themselves. Whatever they did it to survive, to buy their drugs, to carry on. So whenever they were brought in a trial as a witness, they were instantly deemed as dishonest. And this is what we're seeing now when people are coming forward. They are rubbish and they're broken. And one of the startling things that occurred was back in the beginning of 2000, they brought over Mayor Giuliano from New York to preach to us on a thing called the broken window theory. And what his theory was, that if there was an area that of depravity that had a broken window or a damaged bus shelter, clean it up, smarten it up, you won't get your drug dealers, you won't get your shoplifters, you won't get, you know, your robberies, that all these crimes that are in the periphery around sort of poverty and everything else, and therefore your society gets better. Smarten these broken windows up. It was naive at the least. Where is this timeline taken back? The fact is they're doing drugs because they're paying for heroin. They're on heroin because heroin is an analgesic. It's a painkiller. Pain can be mental, emotional, as well as physical. And the majority of them were there doing the drugs because they come from the care system. The care system that had appallingly let them down and that they had been sexually abused and they had no way of processing the damage that had been done to them. Our judicial system sets them up to fail. It follows them through from cradle to grave. These kids are known about, yet nothing happens. They grow up, they become bad in class, they become violent. They get reported to the social services, yet the problem is still not addressed. They then commit minor acts and end up before the juvenile courts. Again, nothing is done. They commit then heavier acts, robberies or whatever, and end up before the magistrates' courts, yet nothing is done. They end up before the Crown Courts, and ultimately they end up going before the coroner's courts. Yet throughout all this circle, nothing ever breaks it. The people that are paid a good living wage to stop this are failing it. And sometimes it's deliberate. Sometimes it's apathy. Sometimes it's ignorance. I've just come back from Rotherham, a small steel town in the northwest cluster of the UK. I met with a social worker who had exposed the child prostitution problem. She ran an outreach group and the kids were coming to her, and then one would tell her, another, and she looked into it. It was organised prostitution. It's a small little town. 2,000 children were being pimped out. She got attacked. She got attacked from the police. Her husband nearly lost his job. It nearly brought her to this point of suicide. And this is what they do. It's orchestrated and it was manipulated at the highest echelons. And she said it was coming from the high-ranking officers. And it was. But yet all they would offer up would be the lower-ranking officers for some form of malfeasance, whatever. But it is being orchestrated at the very top. My investigation showed a strong link with high-ranked officers and organised criminals. I spoke with another child abuse investigator in a quite high ranked officer, and I spoke to him from Manchester. Again, he had a proven link between high ranked officers and organised criminals and child prostitution there. We had a glimmer of hope in the form of a chief constable, a commissioner of police for a county called Wiltshire. The man's name is Mike Veal. He stood up and he investigated child prostitution, child trafficking, child abuse, everything else, but involved former Prime Minister Ted Heath. He turned around in Parliament and he said, if they can attack me, because he come under attack, and he said he came under attack from places he didn't even know existed. And he said, if they can attack me, God knows what they'll do to John Wedger, which in a way was a bit of an accolade. But, and I spoke to him and he said, it's just vile, John. It is vile. I then looked at how many police officers, the policeman's biggest fear is going to prison. And they know it. They know it. This is deliberate. What we're looking at is deliberate. I was a good guy. When you're a policeman, you take an oath, and your oath is, I will act without fear or without favour. Someone said to me, John, do not brace your own bravery on others. Don't judge others for the lack of bravery and commitment you've shown. I do not see myself as brave. I see myself as a man who believes in protecting the vulnerable, doing God's work, and doing what my oath said, to act without fear or without favour. They are going against their oath. And I said, we will look at this word fear, shall we? What are they frightened of? Telling the truth, where the real fear lies is this young child laying in a kid's home at night and they're coming and they're taking the blankets from over him. That's the real fear. You know, we need to get a grip. You come under attack, and you do come under attack, and it's painful when it hurts, and it does do its best to destroy you. Maggie Oliver said to me, John, I was going to prison. The CPS turned round and said, we've got enough evidence. If you don't come to some agreement, admit to whatever, then you're found guilty, you will go to prison. She had to tell her children she was going to prison. The CPS in the end with me turned around and said, John Wedger's mitigation was so powerful, we could never convict him. I said to them, I submitted my statement prior to any trial. I wrote a statement and I gave it to Cressida Dick and said, here's my statement. Whatever you say I've done. I don't care. But I will not be tried by you. I will be tried in a Crown Court. And I will be tried by my peers and I will be tried fairly. I've done nothing wrong. And I listed every single person from the bottom right the way up to the top who was involved, who knew about it, who did nothing. Who then did nothing? Who did nothing? This went right up to Bernard Hogan Howe and now to Cressida Dick. Bernard Hogan Howe knew about this. The campaign of bullying on me was orchestrated under his command. He has now been appointed by the House of Lords to look into child grooming gangs and how they existed. Well, I might save him the trouble. I can do that for him. You know, it is wrong. It is wrong there. Looking now, I was asked to make an address to Lord Pearson's office regarding the presence of grooming gangs and how it works, how it's the mechanics of it all. They're looking at it from a very sort of religious background, that it's Muslim gangs. This is a bigger picture. This is a bigger picture. Kids are a commodity. And one of the things which I want to refer back to is yourself, Commissioner, to my right, mentioned about the Mark Dutroux. Whenever I give a talk, you have to make things relevant. We don't look at the third world and how they're dealing with things, because there are different people. They looked, if they drive on a different side of the road, they look a different colour. Let's look at what we got on our backyard. One of the countries that's demographically very similar to us is Belgium. In living memory, it went on in Belgium, you know, and it went on with Mark Dutroux. And the kids that came forward were so pigeonholed in what they could talk about. Anything that went outside of Mark Dutroux, they weren't allowed. I think it was 23 to 25 civilian witnesses died in the lead up to the trial.
90.
Unbelievable.
Total 90.
Absolutely unbelievable, yep. And then the people took the power back. They blew the windows out with the fire engines of the parliamentary office. And then they sprayed horse manure all over the building and they took to the streets, didn't they? Half a million people. Half a million people. And what do? We only kick off when someone throws a cat in a wheelie bin. If we allow our children to be attacked and preyed on in this way, we have failed as a decent and moral society. And we are doing that. And we are doing nothing. It has to stop. And they have to back. I don't want no glory, but people like myself, we need backing. And we need it.
Absolutely.